Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In conjunction with Philbrook Museum's exhibit In Living Color, featuring the work of Andy Warhol, today we hear about the cross-country road trip Warhol took in the late summer of 1963. This four-day road trip to L.A. from New York along Route 66 for the opening of his exhibit of Liz Taylor and Elvis images proved to be an incubator for a total reimagining of his persona and image. Writer Deborah Davis says that the artist left New York as Andy, but returned as Warhol, the artist, auteur, filmmaker, and scene maker. In her book, The Trip, Andy Warhol's Plastic Fantastic Cross-Country Adventure, Davis says that the road trip provided a deeper meaning for Warhol. By seeing the country just as it was beginning to homogenize, the trip reinforced his notions behind pop art. The trip tells the story of Andy Warhol's beginnings as an artist, plus a larger story of a culture on the edge of a massive shift. And that has been the larger focus of a number of Deborah Davis's books, which include Guest of Honor, Booker T. Washington, Theodore Roosevelt, and the White House Dinner That Shocked a Nation, Strapless, John Singer Sargent, and the Fall of Madame X, and The Party of the Century, the fabulous story of Truman Capote and his black and white ball. She'll be appearing at Philbrook Museum Wednesday evening for a program titled On the Road with Warhol. It gets underway at 7 o'clock Wednesday evening at the museum for a discussion of the Oklahoma section of the road trip, Elvis, Liz Taylor, and much more, and it's free to the public. Deborah Davis is my guest today. Deborah Davis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
So happy to be talking to you.
You specialize in writing books about a singular event, Booker T. Washington being invited to the White House by Theodore Roosevelt, or the story of John Singer Sargent painting Madame X and the scandal that ensued, or in this case, Andy Warhol's trip across the country. And you tell a larger story about the times, but from what I can see, this actual road trip sort of happened at a seminal point in his career in which the Andy Warhol before that road trip was very different than the Andy Warhol afterwards.
Yes, and that's what attracted me to the story. It's all about transformation. This cross-country adventure that seemed to be, you know, to anybody on the outside, just a road trip, was actually a defining moment in Andy's life. And more interesting than that, it was a window into seismic shifts in America. Everything changed. Art, literature, movies, drugs, music, sex. You know, sex was actually invented in 1963.
Now you're going to have to explain that comment.
Well, nobody had sex before that, or at least they didn't have sex the way they did after 1963. You know, this was the time of revolution, and we always say the 60s, but what we really mean is 1963. You know, all the lines can be drawn to that, and to Andy, too. You know, he started out the year as Andy, and he ended up the year as Warhol, you know, the iconic figure we know. And I believe that all of that change happened to him while he traveled cross-country and then subsequently spent a week in Los Angeles.
Now, prior to Warhol going to Los Angeles, he'd had some success in New York and was starting to be successful as a fine artist as opposed to illustrator, which he had been a great illustrator. And for that reason alone, he probably received more than his share of resentment and resistance to his work as a fine artist.
Well, yes, having been an illustrator and a very, very highly paid one, I mean, I was just shocked to learn that he was pulling in maybe $70,000 a year, which, you know, in today's money would be over $400,000. And this was just by drawing shoes. And remember, it was this explosive time of advertising. So his work was, you know, very high in demand. But like so many artists, he really wanted to be a fine artist and to have gallery showings and to be appreciated and collected. And, you know, the problem was that with pop art, people were looking at it very suspiciously and saying, is this art, you know, or is it a joke? So Andy had to, you know, really combat that. And this was very early in his career as a painter, you know, 1962, 63. So he was trying very hard to be taken seriously.
Now, you also mentioned that the dirty little secret was he was not the only fine artist that was dealing in commercial art. Except those other artists were using pseudonyms when they when they did it.
Yes. I mean, Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg, I mean, they called themselves Mattson Jones. And they were window dressers. That's how they made a living. And actually, their windows were extraordinary. I mean, some photographs have survived that show that, you know, even window dressing was a form of art. But, you know, they would never admit that they were doing anything commercial. Unlike Andy, who was very happy to say, yes, I'm a commercial artist and I want to be a painter.
Hmm. Now, you sort of go into his process that he went through to sort of find his way. He'd been doing illustrations, which in a way were sort of pop art in and of themselves. But he actually started out making cartoon characters, Unfortunately, he came right at the same time as Roy Lichtenstein. And Roy Lichtenstein already had representation.
Yeah, he was a little bit too late, but he found all of his inspiration in the most ordinary places. You know, the daily newspapers. That's where, he found the comics. That's also where he found all of those kind of trashy ads for, you know, nose jobs and stomach binders and you know, wart remedies. And to him, this was inspiration. And then ultimately, you know, he found inspiration in the most commonplace, the supermarket, a can of Campbell's soup, you know, something that he ate every single day. And that's when people really had to ask themselves, is it art?
Now, that was the first sort of what we would consider Andy Warhol pop series, was the soup cans, correct?
Well, he also did Coca-Cola bottles, mm-hmm. and, you know, they were completely pop in that they had no embellishments. They were as you saw them. And the Campbell soup cans, he literally, you know, painted one of each variety and then had them displayed as if they were on a supermarket shelf.
Yeah. You also write that at the very beginning, he was very aware of where he was when he was doing this fine art. I mean, this was still the era of abstract expressionism. And so his very first images sort of had this sort of smudgy sense to them, as if he's trying to sort of meld this very realistic depiction, as what would later come to be, with abstract expressionist tendencies, if you will.
Yes, because, you know, it was very hard to, you know, that was the big, it was still the big art movement. And it was very hard to break from that completely. So if he did a Coke bottle, he would put a few, you know, emotional squiggles to show that the artist was present. You know, this is my interpretation of a Coca-Cola bottle. But a good friend of his who, you know, was very astute in these areas gave him the best piece of advice ever. He said, lose all of the interpretive stuff. Just show it the way it is, naked on the wall. And, you know, that's a true expression of who we are today. And he was right.
Yeah. So by the time 1963 rolls around, he's had a show in New York. He's had some success. He was also commissioned to do his first major portrait, I guess. And that would be of Ethel Stull, correct?
Yes.
And this became very much a stylized part of his work afterwards. And this was the first time where he did the multiples within a work, a single work.
It was a fascinating concept because, you know, multiples, you know, talking about society at the time, were happening everywhere, whether it was, you know, motels where you could stay at the same Howard Johnson and it would look exactly the same. You know, those were multiples. McDonald's, that was multiples. You know, a hamburger was the same every place you got it, and, you know, you could get them everywhere. Even cars. And Andy took this idea and turned it into art. So, you know, we all remember photo booths. You know, you walk into a photo booth and you get four very funny pictures of yourself, you know, instantly. Turns out these pictures are really good. It's hard to get a bad picture of yourself in a photo booth. So Andy took Ethel Skull. She thought she was going to some, you know, fancy photographer like Avedon. He took her to Times Square, put her in a photo booth, fed it with, you know, $100 worth of quarters, and kept telling her, change, you know, new position, and walked away with the most incredible photo booth shots of her, multiples, and then turned them into panels of portraits. And there she is on the wall 36 times, looking incredible, very glamorous, and a new art form was born.
Mm. And you also notice at the very beginning of this, before this road trip, he's starting to get interested in film. And you said one of the things he did in the, while he was feeding quarters into the photo booth was he was directing her.
Yes, telling her, you know, what to do, turn this way, turn that way. And I think at this moment he was emulating the old form of movie director. That changed once he got to Hollywood because he understood intuitively that he had to do something different. He had this Bolex camera. He didn't really know how to use it, and he decided that he would make his first feature film in Los Angeles, saw a road sign that said Tarzana, and got the idea, I'll make a Tarzan movie. Well, his Tarzan, you know, if you could look up Andy's Tarzan, he is the most underfed Tarzan in existence. He's the underground actor Taylor Mead. He was along on the trip with Andy and his friends. He weighs about 92 pounds. He never met a muscle. And so he's Andy's Tarzan. And Andy realized while he was making this film that the best way for him to direct was to do nothing. The more withholding he was, the more his actors would do anything, even take their clothes off, just to get his attention.
Yes, yeah, so this involves another one that would be associated, another person would be associated with Warhol, especially at the factory, and that would be Naomi Levine.
Yes, his first superstar, a young woman who, you know, followed Andy out on this California trip. She wasn't invited to drive with them in the car, but she got herself there, and she became Jane in this Tarzan movie. And she just couldn't get Andy's attention. So systematically, she, you know, would remove one garment after another until she was naked. Now, this didn't happen in movies then. And, you know, ultimately, he would keep the camera on her if she had her clothes off. So everybody really went to daring lengths just to get Andy's attention.
And you, earlier you were saying, you know, this is when sex was invented, but really what you're talking about is this sort of, the 50s really ended in 1963, and all of a sudden you have the pill, you have the assassination of JFK, you have distrust of government institutions, you have this sort of sea change that was starting to happen. It was really the first currents in the art world where you're breaking taboos, you're breaking all sorts of conventions.
Yes, it started in the art world and it spread like wildfire because all of a sudden nothing mattered. It was the attitude was, why not? Everything's changing. All of the rules are breaking down. The old way doesn't work. And it was the rise of youth culture. And let's face it, you know, young people are reckless. They'll do anything. Now, ironically, Andy wasn't that young. He was 35, but he was a very immature 35. And I think that there was a tremendous appetite to try anything new. And sex at that point, you know, was being experienced in a new way, a new, freer way. All of the magazines, the major magazines, had articles, cover stories about the new morality. And it was something that everybody was paying attention to.
And, of course, with Andy Warhol, you know, everything was stacked away. He cataloged everything. What was really interesting about this trip is all the receipts survived from this trip, correct?
Oh, Rich, I was the luckiest writer in the entire world. You know, I set out to write the story, and I'm thinking, how will I ever know what Andy actually did on this cross-country trip? Well, it turned out that he saved absolutely everything. In boxes, he called time capsules, but what they really were, you know, we'd probably call them garbage cans. He would just throw everything into them. When they were full, they got sealed. There are hundreds of them. And it was my good fortune that the box containing the receipts for this trip had been opened and examined, and the Andy Warhol Museum provided me with these receipts, and suddenly I had a road map of every place Andy went, where he shopped, where he ate, the motels where he slept, you know, the toll receipts that told me his route, and I was literally able to take these receipts and pin them to a map and follow in his footsteps by making the trip myself.
Now, what were the circumstances that led to the trip? Because I think he, if I remember correctly, he had already had one show in Los Angeles. This was the second show, correct?
That's right. His Campbell Soup Can show had taken place in Los Angeles, and a year later, the gallery, the Ferris, offered him the opportunity to show portraits of Elizabeth Taylor and Elvis Presley. And his new friend, Dennis Hopper, had said to him, if you ever come to L.A., I'll give you a movie star party. That was it. This time, Andy was going cross-country. He was not missing a movie star party for anything.
And one of the things you write in the book at this point, you know, Andy is still seeking, I suppose he was always seeking fame, but he was certainly seeking fame at this particular point because, again, because of this illustrator background, I guess there was a sense that he was just not as first class a fine artist because of this illustration background. So he really was seeking fame. He was trying to become more famous.
Oh, completely. I mean, he would say, when will I be famous? it really meant something to him, and celebrities meant something to him, and Hollywood meant something to him. Even as a small child, he collected pictures of Shirley Temple and other stars and put them into scrapbooks. Hollywood was everything to him.
So Hopper invites him out to throw a party for him, and so that's it. So, but here's a problem. One would think you would fly, but he decides to drive. I would assume that's part of the on-the-road mystique involved with that, but Andy's got a problem. He doesn't drive.
He does not have a license. He tried twice, and he couldn't. He just couldn't get the hang of driving. So, you know, that wasn't going to happen. So he had to find a car and a few drivers, and he had a friend who had a Ford Falcon station wagon. He assembled, you know, a group of four, the friend with the car, Win Chamberlain, Taylor Mead, the underground actor, Gerard Malanga, Andy's young, gorgeous assistant, and the four of them got into this Ford Falcon station wagon, which was the automotive industry's answer to pop, and they just drove, you know, their way cross-country, but they had only 4.5 days to make it to the party. And luckily, they were fueled by all of those great 60s drugs, you know, that could get you anywhere really, really fast.
In fact, your writing says, you know, Andy started taking amphetamines during this time, and what it turns out really to be, this drug he was taking was sort of an early version of Adderall.
It was. I was shocked to find that out. You know, he talked a lot about this drug, Obitrol, and everybody took Obitrol. You know, it was a very common thing, and Andy liked to say it gave you that go, go, go feeling in your stomach and, you know, made you infinitely productive. So I was reading about Obitrol, and I discovered that it was taken off the market, reformulated, and then re-released as Adderall. And I would love to see the bumper sticker that says, Andy Warhol took Adderall.
Well, my guest today is Deborah Davis. Her book is titled The Trip, Andy Warhol's Plastic Fantastic Cross-Country Adventure. It's published by Atria Books, and she's our guest on Studio Tulsa. Now, the three companions for this road trip, these were all very noted people who, I mean, had these very interesting careers themselves. Win Chamberlain was a fine artist himself, and then wrote books later. Gerard Malanga wrote poetry. He was Andy's assistant and sort of the foreman. I think you refer to him as the foreman of the factory. And Taylor Mead was this sort of Neil Cassaday sort of figure of being this underground actor who was absolutely outrageous. And the four of them go across country and actually traveled through Tulsa on their way through. They took Route 66.
They did take Route 66. And when I did my trip, I had the most unbelievable experience in Oklahoma. So I again had Andy's receipts, and sometimes I could even guess, you know, what the actual restaurant was where he stopped just from descriptions that he had left. And I went to a place called Clanton's Cafe in
Benita.
Yeah. And I asked if there were anybody there who had been working there in the early 60s. And they called up Tommy Clanton, the owner. He had been there in the 60s, and he walked over to talk to me. And I said nothing about Andy Warhol or my purpose there. I just asked him, do you remember anyone unusual coming in the early 60s? And he said instantly, well, there was a strange-looking guy and he had little pictures of Marilyn Monroe and Sody Pop. And I said, why would you remember that? And he answered me, why wouldn't I remember that? Everybody who came into Clanton's in the early 60s had on boots and a cowboy hat, and they were local. And he had never forgotten this. And all I can say is that Andy Warhol ate at Clanton's Cafe.
And one of the things you said that Andy began to understand on this trip was, you know, he's sort of delving into pop, but when you're seeing billboards, as you were at that particular time across the country, billboards everywhere, all of a sudden he's beginning to understand this larger pop mentality.
He was shocked that America, what he called the real America, would look so pop. He said the farther we drove, the more pop everything looked on the highways. The billboards, the neon, it was like a great museum to him of all of the images, you know, he was digesting and you know, creating. And there, all of a sudden, the American landscape looked exactly the way Andy Warhol would have designed it. So he loved every minute of it. You know, other people called the billboards billboard blight, and they would soon disappear, you know, a few years later. But Andy thought they were sensational.
Now, the other thing you write that he discovered was how different it was still the 50s in the Midwest and sort of in the West. Girls are still wearing bobby socks. You know, it's the fashions have changed on the East Coast. But there was sort of this lag of years in the Midwest. And I think that struck him as well.
It did. Every place had an atmosphere and a culture and a look all its own. And that, sadly, is something we have lost to an extent. You know, certainly I noticed that traveling cross-country. But he celebrated it. I mean, there was one incident where he and his goofy friends, you know, walked into a diner in the Midwest, and, you know, they were surrounded by teenagers saying, where do you come from, and, you know, what do you call the way you look? And Andy said the alien alert was on, and he did feel a little threatened. But he reveled in the differences that he experienced all the way, you know, at every stop.
As you were traveling, Wes, you followed his journey. What struck you most, and what struck Andy most about the journey, Wes? Because a lot of it was about getting to Los Angeles, so it's about the 4 days to get to Los Angeles by car. So, I mean, a lot of it was just hard driving, but was there any sort of greater knowledge from having done this cross-country trip?
Well, I think that it really validated his vision of the world, you know, when he was sitting in, because he didn't drive, so he was just, you know, this passenger sitting in this fishbowl, essentially, you know, staring out at America, at this panoramic, you know, scenery that he had never, ever seen before, the landscapes, and then the nightscapes, you know, the neon, the billboards, you know, all of the Americana, all of those wonderful sights on Route 66 where you could see, you know, the biggest this and the best that and the architecture. I think he digested all of it. And when he got to California, too, it became a part of him. And he also understood that you could really transform yourself, that all of these experiences could help you to become a different person. And that's exactly what he did.
And so how was he different in Los Angeles than he was, say, in New York? I mean, give us a sense of this transformation. Was it a matter of he was being feted at that particular time and sort of changed his demeanor because he was sort of like the star of the party?
He saw that, especially in Hollywood, that people really could transform and repackage themselves every day. You could always be a different person in Hollywood. And yes, he was getting this attention from Dennis Hopper and, you know, all of these people who he admired. So he came up really with a new persona. What he had learned from directing about being withholding, suddenly he stopped speaking in sentences. He was very, you know, the person who didn't stop talking before in New York, very chatty. And now he started speaking in monosyllables, yes, no. He started dressing in black, you know, the leather jacket, the black pants, wearing sunglasses, because it was a new persona, and it was a much more commercial one. So by the time he came back, he was Warhol. That's who we know, Warhol with the silver wig. You know, his wig wasn't as extreme before this trip. Warhol with the dark glasses all the time. Warhol who just kind of smiled and didn't say much. This was a character who he created in the process of traveling from one end of the country to the other.
Now, how was that revisioning accepted when he came back to New York? Did the success in Los Angeles that he was receiving sort of make it back to New York?
Well, he came home and, you know, opened the Silver Factory, and it became, which was really just, you know, a studio. It was where he was producing his art. But that, coupled with this new persona, made him the white-hot center of social and cultural life in New York City. Suddenly, everybody wanted to be a part of this, you know, this very enticing underground world. And they were, you know, falling over themselves to get into the factory.
Now, he was already making films in New York. I think the Kiss was made before he left for Los Angeles, right?
And
this
yes,
was, and we don't think much about this. We just think of it as sort of like this sort of conceptual film. But the whole thing was it was flouting the Hays Code, which said you couldn't kiss for longer than 3 seconds. And here it is. It's what how many minute film of just a kiss?
Well, that's what he was rebelling against the code. And showing, you know, Naomi Levine in a series of kisses with all different men, not, you know, anyone with whom she was particularly involved. They were just, you know, acting. And he kept the camera going. And what was really interesting, though, was that he decided to project the film at a slower speed, which made it look more like a silent film. And so you had this wonderful tension between, you know, the subject matter, which was, you know, people really kissing. I mean, this kiss is all about tongues. yet it's projected in a way that makes it look old-fashioned. So Andy understood that wonderful, you know, tension that you could have in your work where it was today and yesterday and tomorrow at the same time.
Hmm. Well, from what I read in the book, it sounds like this trip really changed his mindset and sort of his persona. And I guess being in Hollywood, seeing that sort of very different way of carrying yourself than New York, really profoundly affected him and affected his art too.
It affected everything. And you know, he came home saying, making these wonderful, you know, statements that we repeat all the time now. Statements like, I am deeply superficial. he knew exactly, you know, how to work it, and people loved it. They you know, just thought, this is a very, very interesting person. You know, but the really interesting thing is that he wasn't all style. He was totally substance. You know, today his paintings command millions of dollars. He has a whole museum dedicated to his work. He laid the foundation for independent film, and he's credited with having invented the selfie and Instagram. Hmm. You know, what more can we say?
The name of the book is The Trip. Deborah Davis, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time.
Deborah Davis is the author of The Trip, Andy Warhol's Plastic Fantastic Cross-Country Adventure. It's published by Atria Books. She'll be in Tulsa Wednesday evening for an appearance at Philbrook Museum of Art in conjunction with their exhibit In Living Color. That program gets underway at 7 o'clock, titled On the Road with Warhol. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.